So before we hop into the sermon this morning, which you may be wondering about with the title up there, I just want to notice something and name it. How much light and love you guys are putting in the world. And as we sit and as I hear these prayer requests coming, I think, man, think about all the people that we know and care deeply about and that we're in relationship with. And I'm just so grateful. And as we sang this song, Water Our Lives, I thought, yeah, God's doing that. God's doing that. I'm really grateful to be part of a body that is about that. So thank you all for being those kind of people. As you know, we're following the story of David this summer. And we took a break last week to look at the Psalms. And so to remind you of where we're at, Saul has been chasing David around the wilderness. They have encountered each other in a cave, and David has spared Saul's life. And that's kind of where we're at, as you're tracking with us on this. So David is still running away from Saul, even though Saul has said, David, you're doing the right thing. I know you're not out to kill me. Saul's still chasing David around, trying to kill him. And so we're at the beginning of 1 Samuel 25. And there's this really brief thing at the beginning of 1 Samuel 25. It's just the very first verse. It says, and Samuel dies, and all Israel goes to mourn him. And it's kind of such a brief aside that you almost miss it when you read this chapter. And yet this is a really important marker. And it influences how David, I think, acts in this chapter. And it influences what's going on in Israel. So Samuel's been the priest. Samuel anointed Saul. That didn't really work out that well. Samuel has anointed David. And so we have this conflict around the kingship. And Samuel's death marks a passage. It marks a passage for Israel because it's now we're officially away from this time of the judges and the prophets who were, you know, leading. If you remember this in Israel, this is how this worked for a long time. Samuel's dead, so this is over. Like, we're totally into the realm of kings now in Israel. And the other really significant thing about this, not that David and Samuel were super close or anything, and yet Samuel is the connection that David has to the promise that's been made. Does that make sense? Samuel's playing this major role, both for Israel overall and for David specifically. So it just sort of throws it out there at the beginning of the chapter and then just moves on. Like, you're going to get this. Samuel's dead. This is a thing, right? So that's important. And it's important to remember that David is out running around in the wilderness with a band of essentially vigilantes. This isn't actually a picture of them. But I think if we were to sort of modernize it, this is kind of what this looks like. David is out with a bunch of rowdies in the wilderness. And he's grieving the death of Samuel. And then it sort of shifts. And it's interesting to think about this this particular passage. I was talking with my dad, noted Old Testament scholar Howard R. Macy, this week. And he said, you know, I've never preached on this passage, nor have I ever heard anybody else preach on this passage. And I went, oh, okay, fools rush in. So this is an interesting story. And I think as we move through it, we're going to take some time to look at some of the cultural implication of it, because there's a lot of stuff that I think we miss. This story basically starts out with this. So once upon a time, there was this rich idiot. And it continues, and his beautiful, smart, and sensible, and clever wife. So you have some sense of the nature of this story by this intro. Now, Nabal, who we have Mr. Bean representing this morning, is a super rich guy. He's got, they give the numbers of his flocks. It's like in the thousands. He's well-to-do. And this is the time of year that the shepherds are out. They're getting ready to shear the flocks. They're doing the work of business, if this makes sense. And David's vigilante folk are in the area. Now, you have to realize you got a group of vigilantes. You have a group of, like, yahoos. They're going to act like yahoos, even if they're under David, right? And this is the fear that Nabal has. You got this group of folks running around in the wilderness that are maybe not trustworthy. And yet, it turns out, it says very specifically, David and his fellas do not harm the shepherds that are out there. In fact, they help take care of them. That makes sense? So we've got a kind of picture of what's going on. David is defending Nabal's interest, even though he doesn't have any particular reason to. So he sends some folks to Nabal to say, hey, you know, we took care of you. We took care of your shepherds. We took care of your sheep. We made sure your business interests were good. Do you think you could feed us? Essentially. And Nabal instead of taking this seriously and going, well, that's good, decides he's going to insult David instead. Nabal says this, "Who is David? Who is this son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and the meat that I have butchered for my shearers and give it to men who come from I don't know where?" That's a pretty good slap in the face. Like, who the heck are you? And after David has spared Saul's life and Saul has recognized, oh, you're not going to just kill me to get what you want. Like, you're doing this right. To have Nabal turn around and say, yeah, you're unfaithful. You're a jerk. You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing at all. This is what Nabal is saying here. One of the commentators I read this week said, it's more than foolish for Nabal to refuse hospitality to David, who had acted spontaneously on his behalf. It was dangerous. And on a feast day, it was insulting, because the Israelites were expected to be hospitable to sojourners, especially on feast days. So Nabal is denying good for good. He's going out of his way to insult David. Who do you think you are? There's a lot of people who are faithless. Why should I help you out? And David doesn't think this is clever or funny. He's furious. He's ready to trade not only insult for insult, but to violently seek revenge. He says, every man strap on his sword, and every one of them strapped on their sword, and David also strapped on his sword, and about 400 men went up after David. So we get this picture that the vigilantes are coming for Nabal. Like, this is not going to end well for him, and he's so much of an idiot, he doesn't even know this is what's going on, right? And this is dangerous, and it's scary, and it's also kind of funny. Like, this guy is an idiot. He's getting what he deserves, right? So as David is on his way with his 400 men to go find Nabal, Abigail shows up. And we've heard about Abigail earlier. This is Nabal's wife. And she's heard what's going on from the servants. And they've essentially said, David's doing the right thing. And Nabal is, in fact, a fool. And we're dead. So Abigail heads out to make this right, or at least avoid a total catastrophe. And she grabs a ton of food and goes to head David off. She finds David and falls at his feet and says, upon me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. My Lord, do not take seriously this ill-natured fellow, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name and folly is with him, but I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. So it's important to know here that Nabal means literally fool. Like, literally, that's what this means. And Abigail's saying, that's right. He is that idiot that you thought he was. So don't take that seriously. He's just an idiot. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, since the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from taking vengeance with your own hand, my Lord shall have no cause for grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause or for having saved himself. And when the Lord has dealt with my Lord, then remember your servant. Well, this is kind of funny, right? You have the wife of this guy come out and go, never mind that idiot, right? And some of you understand this. You've been in that kind of relationship maybe, or had those moments. And Abigail's being incredibly brave because she comes out and says to David, I'll take all the blame. That's brave. And she's being amazingly smart. She gets the pragmatic stuff that's going on here. David has been insulted. She wants to make that right. David has a hungry army to feed. And David cares about being a good guy. So she speaks to all of these needs. She's humble. She strokes David's ego. She brings food and plenty of it. And she reminds David gently of his desire to do the right thing. And it works. David grants her petition and clarifies what he had in mind. And also is reminded of his call to faithfulness. It reminds him of who he knows he's supposed to be. And he talks about what he knows, what he was going to do. He says, essentially, if you hadn't headed me off, I would have killed every male on your property. For the moment, David and Abigail part ways, and David apparently enjoys the feast she's brought to him, and Abigail goes home to deal with Nabal. When she gets home, Nabal is in the middle of a major party. It is harvest time, after all, and he's really drunk. And in a sense, she shows some really good sense here and says, and maybe some sense of justice here, we should say too, that she'll wait till the next day so she's not talking to a drunk guy to explain what's happened. So she does, and when he's sobered up but is likely dealing with a terrific hangover, she tells Nabal that he's narrowly missed being killed. Nabal is understandably dismayed. Says when Abigail told him these things, his heart died within him. He became like a stone. And the shock apparently didn't wear off because 10 days later, he's died. To which the narrator attributes that action to God. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. David says, "Blessed be the Lord who has judged the case of Nabal's insult to me and has kept his servant from evil. The Lord has returned the evil doing of Nabal upon his own head." And then for good measure, he marries Abigail. Walter Brueggemann says, 1 Samuel 25 is an exceedingly subtle and complex narrative with well-articulated characters and artistically rendered speech, which is an academic way of saying, this is a hard passage to make sense of. It's really important to understand the cultural setting and implications that are here. We sometimes forget that we're not the original audience for these stories, and so we miss the subtext because we don't understand the culture. And often we try to squeeze these passages into our own cultural paradigms. But all of this is so far from any of our experience that it takes some intention to try to understand the story on its own terms rather than ours. It's a funny story, or at least it's a story told with irony and comic intention. You get that, you know, from the Hebrew perspective, if you name somebody the fool to start the story, you would guess that maybe there's going to be some funny things that are happening. There's some funny plays on words here. Nabal can mean, like, the roots of these words can mean, like, an empty wineskin, so that points to the fact that he's drunk. It also can mean it's dead man walking. So you, from the beginning of this passage, you go, this guy's in trouble. There's some other clues here that are important in thinking about how we think about this might affect us. If we're paying attention, from the very beginning, Nabal is defined by his property. Before we even know his name, the first description of him was, there was a rich man. His economic status leads him to deny societal norms of hospitality, and it leads him to self-sufficiency. And in contrast, Abigail is the opposite. She's everything that the culture at the time would have wanted a wife to be. She's beautiful, smart, considerate, helpful, and this is a subversive story. Abigail, the faithful wife, is being faithful by going behind her husband's back in order to save his life. It's against his wishes that keep him from being killed. And it's noteworthy that a story that comes from such a patriarchal culture, about a macho spitting contest, if you will, takes time out to feature a woman in a role of leadership and wisdom. There's also a broader narrative to David's road to kingship. He's emotionally and pragmatically in a tough spot. His life is in danger from Saul. He's lost his advocate in Samuel's death. And he's being called unfaithful by a guy who's gone out of his way to treat him well and protect. And so there's reasons why David might react violently, and there's consequences to that potential reaction. So far, David has avoided using violence as a means to power. And killing off wealthy landowners, no matter the insult and how unlikable and stupid they might be, is not good political optics, nor is it faithfulness. Is David to be made king by God's action or by his own? It also pragmatically works out for David. In allegiance with Abigail, David has now more wealth and influence, but he's done it without conquest. He listens to Abigail's guidance, and he doesn't take her as a wife by force, but instead woos her. This is a foreshadowing and contrast to his future action with Bathsheba and Uriah, which we'll get to later, but where he acts upon his own emotion and power and ignores what righteousness means. So we're not here this morning to load up on trivia of the Davidic kingdom, as interesting or funny as it might be. But we come to Scripture to hopefully encounter God. So what's our takeaway? One of the things to carry with us here is that we trust God to take care of the vengeance business. Brueggemann puts it this way: running through the narrative is a powerful theme, the righteousness of David and the fidelity of Yahweh. In the end, Abigail and David both trust and affirm that vengeance belongs to the Lord and not to us. And this is a theme that shows up over and over again throughout all of Scripture. Particularly in the Psalms, we see it, and elsewhere. Our job is to be faithful. God's job is to take care of the justice. Romans 12, 17 through 21 says this: don't repay anyone evil for evil, but take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave room for the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, and I will repay, says the Lord. No, if your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they are thirsty, give them something to drink, for by doing this you will heap burning coals on their heads. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So things being made right really isn't quite our deal. Faithfulness is. And that's not to say that we don't collaborate in justice or in mercy, but we do that by God's direction. There's also a sense in here that this is a morality tale. Don't be a surly fool. You never see that in like a Hallmark card or up on the wall at the Christian bookshop. Don't be a surly fool. Don't get caught up in your wealth and importance. Don't act on your anger or on your sense of being disrespected. Instead, be hospitable. Care for others. Use what you have for the good of those you encounter. And so when we think about this exceedingly subtle and complex tale, I think there's those two things we can take. Do we trust that God will make things right? And are we willing to be faithful in that trust? Right? That's the first one. And the second one is, there are some sort of common sense things that you can do, like treat other people well. Don't pick fights. Use your gifts for the best that you can. So let's take some time to listen this morning. There'll be a few queries up here. Are we willing to listen to good sense and guidance even in the midst of our desire for justice? Do we trust God to work it out? And are we willing, there should be a use in there, are we willing to use the gifts we have faithfully? So let's take some time to listen, allow Jesus to speak to us. If there's a message that you have for everybody here today, we'd ask that you'd stand and a mic will be brought so we can hear that message. Let's listen to Jesus together.